Good evening, it's 6:30. The Empty Bowls Project in Paducah is an annual charity event where participants hand-glaze ceramic bowls, local restaurants fill them, and people buy them to help feed the area's hungry. But one woman who spent the past year glazing bowls says they do more than meet a simple material need. They feed the soul. Her story, along with the latest from the Kentucky General Assembly, today on Front Page PM from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton, in for Chad Lampe, and this is Front Page PM, bringing you the stories, events, and issues shaping our Four Rivers region. We also bring you Front Page AM Friday mornings at 8:35 and the hour-long Front Page Sunday at 9 a.m. It's been a busy week in the Kentucky General Assembly. An effort to legalize casino gambling died on the Senate floor. The sponsor of a measure to regulate the sale of products containing meth precursor pseudoephedrine withdrew it from consideration, and debate continues over the Commonwealth's dropout age. Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Hallett to provide some perspective on what's happening in Frankfort.
The Kentucky Senate has dealt a blow to Governor Beshear's proposal to allow voters to decide via constitutional amendment if they want expanded gaming in the state. Was this vote yesterday a surprise?
You know, I don't think it was. There was a lot of buildup to it. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of people knew that the vote was going to be close and that it might not favor Governor Beshear. He even said himself in the lead up to all this that, you know, while he thought he had the votes, obviously he wouldn't know until the roll call was called for that vote. And obviously when it was called, they fell well short of the votes they needed to pass that constitutional amendment out of the Senate.
I mean, they needed, what, 23 and they got 16?
That's right. In fact, David Williams, the state Senate president, pointed out that they didn't even get a majority of the Senate, which would have been, I think, 18 or 19 votes. So he kind of basically said, you know, the issue is dead. They didn't even get a majority of the votes. They didn't come close to getting what a constitutional amendment needs. So let's move on from this issue. It's been decided.
So this is over for this session? Nothing that can be like repackaged or represented, possibly?
Well, it always could be repackaged and represented. State Senator Damon Thayer, the Republican senator who sponsored the bill, says he's done with it for this session. He's not going to put it in as a floor amendment to any bill. He's not going to put it in as a committee sub or any other bill. That happens a lot in both chambers when lawmakers want a specific issue that they know won't pass. They'll kill other bills by filing their old bill that can't pass as an amendment. Thayer says he's not going to do that. House Speaker Greg Stumbo says that his chamber obviously is not going to take it up now that it's shown that it can't pass the Senate this session. It's dead for this session. Whether it's dead for good, you know, they've been discussing expanded gambling since 1994. So it's hard for me to believe that come 2013, there won't be some discussion about it again.
That's the perpetual issue in Kentucky.
Until they pass it, I guess.
That's right. So moving on to another topic. Now, you've been in the Kentucky Supreme Court. They've been hearing redistricting dispute has been presented to the court. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, that court ran pretty quickly. It was one of the quickest hearings I've ever heard. They were in and out in about 45 minutes, asked a few questions of the lawyers for Legislative Research Commission, LRC, and of lawyers for the House Republicans and State Senator Kathy Stein, who originally sued over the maps. And it was fairly quick. You know, the LRC lawyers basically want two decades of precedent out the window. They told the court, ignore it, and you can set new precedent, and this is your chance to do so. And, of course, lawyers for the House Republicans and Senator Stein were like, hold on a minute, there's no need to do that. This has worked just fine for 20 years. You know, you need to uphold this lower court ruling, and you need to tell the legislature to get back to drawing maps, and this time draw ones that are constitutional. And, you know, after meeting all day, the Supreme Court decided to issue a quick ruling this afternoon that says exactly that. They ruled the maps unconstitutional. They said that the legislature would have to use the 2002 maps, not the 2012 maps they through this year, but maps from 10 years ago to run in legislative districts this year, and that they would have to draw new maps, of course, according to state and federal law because of the census, that would be for 2014 and on. So they could draw those maps in this session, but with only 25, roughly, legislative days left and they haven't touched the budget, that seems a little unlikely. What's more likely is that they come back in January during what's called the short session during the odd years and try to pass a map for that because it gives them a little extra year to do that. But it was very interesting. The whole process with the Supreme Court took less than 12 hours today, and we already had a ruling on redistricting. So it's kind of a wild day when it comes to that issue.
One of the other hot-button issues is a proposal to require people who need pseudoephedrine to get a doctor's prescription in order to fight these meth labs. Where do we stand on that?
Well, it was kind of interesting. Before, we thought we were going to have one crazy Ringling Brothers circus type day in the Senate yesterday, because we thought that they were going to take up this PSE bill, the pseudoephedrine bill, either before or after they did gambling. But surprisingly, State Senator Robert Stivers withdrew the entire bill before they even voted on the gambling bill. He says that the debate's not dead, but he kind of conceded that having pseudoephedrine as prescription only, just that base statement, probably cannot pass the state Senate this year. So they're looking at some compromises, possibly some dosage limits. Of course, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has pushed this idea of having prescription only for convicted meth offenders, and having dosage limits for everyone, and not making it prescription only for everyone else. And so I don't know if they'll go that far, Senator Stivers will go that far, but they're looking at a few different options, and they'll probably run that bill through committee next week, and we'll have this debate all over again.
Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS newscasts, and you can find his online stories at WKMS.org. Advocates for a constitutional amendment to legalize casinos in Kentucky have had an up-and-down week. The proposal cleared a major legislative hurdle in the Senate's State and Local Government Committee Wednesday, only to fall in the full Senate the next day. Governor Steve Beshear has vowed to continue the effort, but the measure's primary sponsor, Republican Senator Damon Thayer, has thrown his hands up over the matter. Commentator Richard Nelson believes that's just as well. He says casino legislation in the Commonwealth is a sweet deal for the elite, but a bitter one for the local communities in which the casinos would be built.
They say love is blind, but when it's coupled with the prospect of landing on Easy Street, it sometimes appears downright irresistible. On Valentine's Day, Governor Beshear, flanked by several senators in the Capitol Rotunda, channeled all the touchy-feelies remaining in Frankfort and proposed legislation that would bring 7 casinos to Kentucky. It's the sweetheart deal of the session, not for the communities that would be saddled with the casinos, but for an already wealthy industry that is more interested in their bottom line than in the well-being of community. The biggest argument in this decade-long battle for casino expansion rests on the idea that Kentuckians are already gambling at casinos in neighboring states. According to Governor Beshear, quote, "That money is being used to pay for all kinds of services and public infrastructure in those other states. As it stands, we might as well be backing trucks up to the Ohio River and dumping our people's money into the water. We need to keep that money at home," end quote. Fair points, but scratch the surface of those arguments and their persuasiveness is only skin deep. If anything, it becomes clear that if casinos get their hooks into Kentucky's economy, any trucks laden with dollars will be from casinos hauling their loot out of state. Atlantic City, New Jersey is a case study of what casinos leave behind. Within 4 years of opening in 1978, one-third of all retail businesses closed. Restaurants declined from 243 to 146 within 10 years, and by 1997, only 66 independent restaurants and taverns remained. Whenever a corporate giant is granted a monopoly, there is an uneven playing field where the air is sucked out of the proverbial room, and discretionary dollars are sucked from the pockets of the mathematically challenged. How many Atlantic City mom-and-pop restaurants could offer free or discounted meals? How many independent hotels could offer ridiculously sweet deals on rooms? My point exactly. Nor could they offer free tokens and poker chips to bring in new customers because they didn't have a multi-million-dollar casino permission slip from the government. An industry model that is based on getting rich quick, one that bills wagering wealth as legitimate entertainment, and one that elevates hopes and dreams, but more often than not disappoints, is sure to leave bitterness for the losers. In fact, the degree of disappointment can be measured in an increase in crime. Between 1977 and 1990, crime increased in Atlantic City by 230%, and within 3 years of casinos, it was ranked number one in per capita crime in the nation. After a carjacking and murder at the Trump Taj Mahal parking garage in September 2011, a CBS News affiliate pulled police reports from a 2-year time period and found Trump's casino had 368 reports of larceny theft, 25 calls for aggravated assault, 3 for rape, and 4 for murder. Police received the greatest number of calls from the Tropicana Casino, 506 reports of larceny theft, 54 calls for aggravated assault, 9 for rape, and 3 for murder. 1,300 calls for police services were made in that two-year period, hardly the track record that will garner any business friend of law enforcement honors. To be fair, Atlantic City casinos have built substantial infrastructure. High-rises are donned with flashy signs on the outside and decked with glitz and glamour on the inside. Headliners draw crowds, and high rollers come to town and spend big. But think big picture. Are casinos the kind of foundation for a stable economy where the little guy and entrepreneur can compete? Are they ever a sound revenue source for which government should depend? And when did a casino town ever win the Best Place to Raise My Children award? These are questions that Christian County residents will have to answer, since it is on the short list of possible locations for a casino. Citizens should be wary by now of the siren song promising a new revenue stream, but caving to such political seduction is more likely to land a good community on the rocks in the long run.
Richard Nelson is a Trigg County Magistrate and Policy Analyst for the Family Foundation. The views expressed in this commentary are the opinion of the commentator and don't necessarily reflect the views of WKMS. The 2011 film playing at Maiden Alley this week harkens back to the early days of Hollywood's golden age in more ways than one. The Oscar-nominated French film The Artist is set in 1927, shot in black and white, and is silent, save for the incredible score and a single line of dialogue. You may have seen films with a similar plot before, but you have likely never seen a love letter to Hollywood so beautifully and meticulously crafted. Larry Thomas and I talk about The Artist. The Artist appears to be a classic Hollywood story told in a very classic manner, a silent movie, that's somehow been nominated for 10 Academy Awards. Can you tell us a little bit about this Hollywood story?
The thing is, there's nothing particularly original about it. It's part A Star is Born and part Singing in the Rain. And, you know, you see pieces of other movies throughout the whole thing. But it is true to the style in that it's silent with intertitles with a music score. At the end, there is like just a little bit of dialogue because it fits into the action as to what's going on. Because it takes place at the transition of silent to sound films. It's shot in black and white, which is gorgeous. It's shot in the original aspect ratio, so it's not a huge widescreen picture. No detail has been spared. Everything looks authentic. The people, not necessarily the stars, but the background actors and the extras, they look like you would imagine people looked in the 20s. Just terrific. To add a little contemporary touch, though, there are some familiar faces in there doing some cameos. John Goodman, Malcolm McDowell. But it's just a beautiful little movie. It's a lot of fun. The lead probably is as close as to somebody you're going to get that looks like Gene Kelly. He's got his smile, he's got his eyes, and he can dance. The young lady who figures into the plot is just charming as all get out. And as I'm sure you've heard, there's a Jack Russell Terrier that steals every single scene he's in.
Well, I was about to say, American audiences might not recognize the lead, Jean Dujardin, and the other lead as well, Berenice Bejo. But as you said, the supporting cast looks familiar and is very solid.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some really interesting shots in there as far as the use of the camera and panorama shots and things like that. It just absolutely tickled me to see this movie. It's got laughs. It's got sadness. It's got no dialogue. It's got dancing. It's got everything you need. It's got a dog.
Well, let me ask you, what have you heard about the appeal of this film? I mean, what is the appeal of a silent film in the 21st century?
The appeal is it's not big. It's not loud. It's not frenzied. I just saw Safe House the other day, and it is all of those. It's got the dark, murky photography. It's got the dreaded shaky cam syndrome in all the action scenes. It's got constant explosions and gunfire and all that. The Artist is a complete 180. It is a true homage to the the classic film style, much as Hugo was.
This sounds like it's the kind of film that, if you want to take someone who has grown up on a diet of, big budget blockbusters and action films, you want to take them to this movie and say, this is how films are made.
Yeah, this is a real film. This is what it's supposed to be. So funny, because my three favorite films of last year were The Artist, Midnight in Paris, and Hugo. And they're all connected with the past and Paris, which makes me think I should get in Rod Taylor's time machine and head back to France.
Ooh, nice reference there.
Yeah.
When you went to go see this, did you run into anybody that didn't like it?
No, and I've heard there has been that problem around the country that some people, I want my money back, there's no dialogue, you know, that kind of stuff. But no, I didn't encounter that at all.
So you can pretty much assure an audience that they're going to really enjoy the experience. If they're open to it, they're gonna love it.
If you're open to it, you will be just bowled over.
You can find showtimes at WKMS.org. When we come back, a conversation with longtime Murray State professor Steve Jones. He was one of the university's first African-American instructors when his tenure began 35 years ago. Then we'll speak with a woman who says her work glazing ceramic bowls for charity has fed her spiritually. You're listening to Front Page PM from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page PM. I'm Todd Hatton. A year after the 1954 U.S. Supreme Court decision Brown v. Board of Education, Murray State University welcomed its first African-American students to class. But it wasn't until 1977 that the school hired its first African-American faculty. Dr. Steve Jones is chair of MSU's Department of Sociology, and he was among those first hired 35 years ago. Dr. Jones is retiring at the end of the semester, and he sat down with Shelley Baskin to talk about what he experienced during his Murray State tenure.
Dr. Jones, you started at Murray in 1977 and were one of a group of the first African-American professors at the university. How did that come about? Were you recruited for the position?
I had just finished my dissertation research, which the location was Little Rock, Arkansas. And I was on my way back to St. Louis, where I was working on my doctorate degree at Washington University. So I stopped in Mayfield because my mother's sister at that time lived in Mayfield. And I should say, too, that this sister, my aunt, was more like a second mother. So when I found out that she wasn't doing very well, I decided that I wanted to stay around and just help her out. So I began to look for a job. I had 7 years of teaching experience at that point, college teaching experience. So I came to Murray.
What kind of culture did you find at Murray when you started working? Were the students and faculty fairly ready to accept you, or was there some animosity?
There were a few experiences where animosity, dislike, prejudice, whatever term you want to use, was operative. But for the most part, my experiences could be described in terms of discomfort, discomfort that people had with me, and discomfort that I had with them, because keep in mind the history here. This was the first time that Murray State had hired African-American faculty. African-American students had only been here since 1955. People weren't necessarily mean-spirited.
Over the years, did you notice changes happening rapidly as far as the feelings of awkwardness and discomfort kind of disappearing? Or is that something that's still around now?
We probably have to acknowledge that this feeling of discomfort, it probably varies as you move from one black faculty person to another, from one time period to another. I think overall, my impression was that the level of comfort increased as the number of African-American students increased, as the number of African-American faculty increased. But there were also things that were changing on the campus itself. So I think as some of these things begin to change, the atmosphere on campus changed. And this is not to say we still don't have some ways to go, but the atmosphere did become more comfortable.
You're now a department chair here at Murray. What was your road like? What led up to you taking that position?
The first opportunity that I had as far as administrative experience was handed to me by Dr. Joe Cartwright. Professor Cartwright was the dean of our college, and our department chair at that time went to Australia for a semester. So Dr. Cartwright gave me the opportunity to be the acting chair. So that was the first administrative experience that I had, and it was important in my career. The big break came after we moved into the College of Health Sciences and Human Services, which was started in 2000. Dr. Betty Blodgett, who was the first dean of College of Health Sciences and Human Services, Dr. Blodgett, after the resignation of our then chair, called each department faculty member in and asked them one-on-one what they thought they needed in terms of the kind of person we wanted as chair. So when I went in and had my discussion, she said, I noticed that you didn't apply for the chair's position. And my response to her was, well, Dr. Blodgett, I'm not sure that Murray State is ready for its second black chair in the history of the university. And I also mentioned to her, which I guess was news, that I had converted to Islam. Not a black Muslim, not a member of the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. I am a Muslim, and I converted right here on this campus. So Dr. Blodgett sort of reared back in her chair when I said those things about first black chair and being a Muslim. She said, I don't think that makes any difference. I want you to think about it. So I did think about it, and I decided that I would throw my hat in the ring, and she selected me as the chair, and I've held that position for about a decade.
Well, overall, what's your experience been? You said you're planning on retiring here soon. Has this been a good experience or a rough one?
Well, there have been trials and tribulations, as I think there always is. Life is a struggle. But I've had some really good experiences. I guess I would single out my relationships in the classroom, my relationships with students have been and continue to be just one of the very exciting and fulfilling parts of my life. Students have, for the most part, been very accepting and understanding. And on some occasions, in some time periods, I've said to myself that maybe my students know me best of all.
Dr. Jones, thank you for talking to me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Last year, local residents glazed hundreds of bowls in preparation for the Empty Bowls Project, a charity event in Paducah organized by ceramic artist Michael Terra. When the handmade bowls are ready, patrons purchase a $15 ticket and fill them with food donated from local restaurants. All of the proceeds benefit the Paducah Community Kitchen. With the second annual Empty Bowls event approaching, Casey Northcutt takes a look at one woman who spent the past year glazing bowls for the project. She says in doing so, she's nourished her own soul.
Yeah, this is all about chemistry.
In a room cluttered with bottles and brushes, a woman stares at a small clay bowl. The bowl has three legs protruding from its base that give it the appearance of a cauldron. Picking up a paintbrush, Joanne, or Joe Dorch, decides it needs a pair of pants.
Each bowl tells you what to do with it by its shape and whatever is the structure in the bowl. You just sort of listen to the bowl and it'll tell you what to do.
So what's this bowl telling you to do?
Make a pair of overalls.
For the past year, Dorch has shown up about once a week at Michael Terra's ceramic studio, Terra Cottage, in Paducah. She spent that time in self-imposed art therapy, shaking up bottles of glaze and applying coats to clay pottery used in the Empty Bowls Project. Terra says he has seen many people find emotional calm in the act of transforming a piece of clay.
It's very quiet. It's very forgiving. And so I think that as people take a breath and allow that to unfold, it's a pretty, for lack of a better word, spiritual moment.
For Dorch, glazing has brought her back from emotional and mental collapse. The 69-year-old woman first walked through Terra Cottage's door in December 2010 to paint a piece for Empty Bowls. At the time, she suffered from emotional and physical exhaustion that quickly approached a breaking point. The day after Christmas that year, she suffered a major breakdown.
I just sat there I mean, I couldn't think and I couldn't react to things.
Dortch says after years of constant caregiving, she snapped. She had been experiencing family ordeals that began in 1989 when her father died and she quit her job to take care of her elderly mother. Then, in the past 11 years, doctors diagnosed her husband with diverticulitis and later an aortic aneurysm and esophageal cancer. Her brother and 5-year-old granddaughter also developed cancer. And through it all, Dortch helped where she could. But eventually, she collapsed. Her daughter, Terry Clark, grew alarmed.
She just got to give up more and more of herself to the point where there wasn't anything left for her. And then it all escalated to the point of her not functioning at all and being hospitalized several times, and they couldn't find any physical reasons. It turned out that it was just all stress and depression.
Yet after the 2010 Christmas season, the innately creative Dortch continued to glaze at Terra Cottage. Michael Terra says she visited several times before he invited her to come weekly. He realized it had started to change her. Dortch first glazed because she felt a responsibility to help the hungry in Paducah, but as she continued, she realized her stress had started to slip away. She had found a method of self-expression she could perform in a quiet space where no one would need her. Back in the ceramic studio, Dortch paints overall straps that run over the lip of her bowl. She smiles as she describes the kindness Michael Terra and his family have shown her over the past year. Terra Cottage has become something of a sanctuary.
Do you have a favorite bowl that you've glazed?
No, I don't think that way. I think of doing artwork is like you just evolve from one into another. I try to be mindful of just the present because I'm just a conduit for what's going on here. I don't take credit for it. I just sort of plug in and try to really see and feel what's happening. And then the next time, maybe you've learned something from that other time.
Today, Dortch's granddaughter, brother, and husband live cancer-free, and therefore so does she. After her breakdown, Dortch has learned to delegate responsibility, which now eases her everyday burdens. But pottery gives her access to creative expression. It gives her an activity to perform for herself. Well, for herself and for hungry people in Paducah. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
This has been Front Page PM, our new regional news segment following Marketplace at 6:30 on Fridays. You may have missed Front Page AM today, now a regular feature at 8:35 Friday mornings. So if you'd like to hear these or any of our stories again, you can find them online anytime at WKMS.org. You can also catch us this Sunday morning at 9 for our hour-long program, Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton. Thanks for listening.